This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest today is film critic Roger Ebert. With film critic Gene Siskel, Ebert co-hosts the television program At the Movies, which features movie reviews and clips from new films. Ebert and Siskel were first paired for the PBS movie review show Sneak Previews. Although Ebert's national reputation has grown through his television work, he still thinks of himself as primarily a newspaper writer. He served as the Chicago Sun-Times film critic since 1967. His writing for the paper won a Pulitzer Prize for criticism in 1975, making Ebert the only film critic to ever win that distinction. Ebert's first book, A Kiss is Still a Kiss, is a collection of his newspaper and magazine profiles of actors and directors. TV viewers may think of Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel as a team because they appear together on their weekly program. But they're also film critics for rival Chicago newspapers. They regard each other more as competitors than partners.
He works for the Tribune. I work for the Sun-Times. One day a week we do the show. The other 6 days of the week, we are indeed competitors. So Siskel and I have been both covering the movies in Chicago for 16 years together, and I started 2 years before him. So it goes back a long way. In fact, when I was asked originally if I would like to do a show with Gene Siskel, my answer was, why Gene Siskel?
Would you ever ask yourself, what did you do to deserve such a fate as having to work so closely with your biggest rival?
There could be worse fates. Gene Siskel is intelligent. He's well-informed. He's a good film critic, and I respect him. And when we are doing our discussions on the air, we do them ad-lib, unrehearsed, spontaneous, and first draft for the most part, unless some terrible mistake takes place. And I'm glad to be able to have him sitting across the aisle from me because I get a lot of feedback and we can talk well together. I think I would feel bad if I had to do the show with somebody who didn't seem to be listening to what I said and wasn't responding to me but was just simply waiting for me to shut up so that he could start.
Are there different assumptions you make about the TV viewers who watch you and what they want when you're reviewing on television and what your readers want and how they read you in the newspaper?
No. No, I think that I am basically addressing the same hypothetical would-be moviegoer in both cases. The difference is that on television, I have an advantage in each place. On television, I have the tool of being able to show part of the movie. In the newspaper, I have more words, and I can deal with more of the plot. If you get into television, into describing the plot of a really complicated movie like Body Double, people are going to completely lose track. So the television gives you more of a direct, here's the movie, here's what it looks like, here's what it sounds like, here's what I thought about it. And the newspaper gives you a little more time to get into some of the details.
Because you're on television, you're a very well-known figure. I'm sure people recognize you all over the country. Has that given you any insights into what it's like for Hollywood actors and actresses who are getting bombarded with autograph requests every time they step out of the house?
It has. It's a strange feeling because I didn't become recognizable until I was into my 30s, so this didn't happen at a very young age. Last Thursday in Chicago, I was interviewing Paul McCartney, and I told him that in the last decade of interviewing stars, he was the first one where people were calling me at the office and saying, you know, take me along to meet Paul McCartney. I mean, I was getting like a dozen calls a day. What can I do to meet Paul McCartney? And I asked him how that made him feel. And he said the only thing that helped him keep his sanity was that when he was a kid, he was a fan. And he hung out outside the Empire Theater in Liverpool waiting for the Crew Cuts to come out because they had a big hit, Earth Angel. And they were nice to him. And they all four signed his program. Next week it was Frankie Lane, and Frankie Lane wasn't nice. And he always remembered that. Well, I could identify with that. I was a fan. You know, I still have letters I received from Stan Freberg, for example, and Bob and Ray. And those are important to me. And so, essentially, it's when people recognize you, instead of treating it like some kind of invasion of privacy, gee, you know, nobody forced me to be on television, I think it's sort of a compliment.
Before you became a professional, before you started writing for newspapers or anything, did you have a desire to make movies or to write about them as a critic?
No. Like a lot of people who started to read in the late 50s, I wanted to be a novelist. I mean, the heroes, when I was going to school, may have been film directors like Antonioni and Fellini, but they were also novelists like Philip Roth. Catherine M. Porter just had a new book out at that time. I started reading in high school, and I started reading, I think, at the age of six, you know. But in high school, I came across the works of Thomas Wolfe at just the right age. I think I was 13 and a half. And this image of this tortured, romantic figure writing novels while standing up and writing on the top of the refrigerator and walking through the dawn saying, I wrote 10,000 words tonight. That was me, you know. I went for that. And Kerouac, On the Road, books like that. And when I was 15 and a half, I started writing sports for the News Gazette in Champaign-Urbana. A sports columnist in Philadelphia, a man named Bill Lyon, also worked on the News Gazette at the same time. I covered Urbana. He covered Champaign. He was into Thomas Wolfe, too. And we would work all night on our stories. We're covering some high school football game, but the lead would have to be perfect. Every word would have to be filled with the passion. You know, Thomas Wolfe covers the Urbana Tigers and the Champaign Maroons. And during the game every year when Champaign played Urbana, you know, it was like Dante was covering it, especially if you lost.
So that's what you started doing for your writing. When did you know, okay, it's movies?
Well, I got into the University of Illinois. I first of all founded a little weekly political and literary paper, which went broke after a year. Then they let me onto the Daily Illini, and I got a weekly column there that I began to use to write about the movies and other things. But I was a graduate student in English when I went to work for the Sun-Times. I was a PhD candidate at the University of Chicago, and I was a feature writer at the paper. Not really thinking of myself as pointed toward movies, although I went to them all the time. And then the film critic retired, and they gave me the job. It was a bolt out of the blue. It was pure good luck. So suddenly I was a film critic. And when people say, what does it take to be a film critic? I think the easiest answer is an opinion and a place to publish it.
But it takes more than that. I mean, you have to, I think, have a passion for movies, don't you? And also have seen a lot of them and understand them well.
Yeah, I think that would help. I think it's extremely important also to be in touch with your feelings about the movies. I don't want this to sound like Leo
Biscaglia
meets Pauline Kael, but actually, now that I brought up Pauline Kael, she gave me some advice in 1967. She said, I go into the movie theater taking in everything that I am and everything that has happened to me and everything that I know. The movie happens to me, and then I write about the difference. In other words, what changed? How did I feel? And then in addition to that, you have things like plot, what you thought about the director's last film in comparison with this one and stuff like that. But basically, I'm not a scholar, and I'm not an academic, and what I'm doing is retailing a subjective emotional opinion, which means there's no right and wrong. There's just how I felt about it and how you felt about it, and here's mine.
Now, you've written a movie also. You wrote
Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, yes.
How did you get to do that?
That was one of the most interesting experiences of my life. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal about Russ Meyer. Well, I'd gone to see Russ Meyer's film, starting with The Immoral Mr. Tease in 1960, and particularly the movies Lorna and Mud Honey, which came out in 64, I think, in 65. And then there was Motor Psycho and Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill. And then Meyer was written about on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. I wrote a letter to the editor. I said, at this point, I was the film critic of the Sun-Times. And I said I was glad that he was finally getting some recognition because he was sort of an unsung talent. The next time he came to Chicago, he showed me a couple of his new movies, and then 20th Century Fox, and we talked, and we found that we could talk to each other. 20th Century Fox asked him to do the film version of the sequel to the awful Jacqueline Suzanne novel and not much better movie, and he said that he didn't want an ordinary, experienced screenwriter who would turn it into just another movie. He wanted somebody who saw things his way. And so he called me in Chicago and asked me to write the screenplay, and I took the job. Went out to Fox. We did the movie in 6 weeks, and it's a very strange film. It's overcrowded. There are too many characters, too many incidents. Things are happening in an unpredictable and strange way, and yet somehow it works as a movie. There are people who don't like it, of course, but it continues to play. It's on midnight programs and in revival theaters, and it was almost as if for 6 weeks the inmates took over the asylum. There we were in the writer's building at 20th Century Fox, laughing maniacally and making up this movie as we went along.
What are some of the most ridiculous things that you put into it and that little touches that you still really love?
Well, for example, somebody today, I was at a bookstore signing copies of my book, And somebody said, I remember that scene when the television talk show was interrupted by the guy who committed suicide by falling on stage. And I said, but I bet you don't realize that was a quotation from Citizen Kane. And he hadn't. And, of course, nobody has. But in Citizen Kane, you know, the opera singer is performing, and then the camera goes straight up into the wings, and there were the two stagehands up there on the catwalk, and one holds his hand, his nose, his fingers to his nose and looks at the other. In the movie, the all-girl rock trio was singing on stage, and then the camera goes up, and there's the boyfriend of one of them, and he falls on the stage and tries to kill himself. Well, that was a little, I mean, doesn't make the movie good or bad, but it just indicates that we were pushing things in through every crevice that we could find. One of the things that people remember from the movie is that the hero, Ronnie Z-Man Barzell, the teenage tycoon of rock, is revealed at the end to have been a transvestite, to have been a woman all along. And we didn't think of that until we got to that scene, which is how the movie was written. You know, up until that point, in my mind and in Russ's mind, he was a man. And then Russ says, we need something very sensational right here. And I said, what? And he said, I don't know, but it really has to blow them out of their seats. And I said, well, what can we do? And he said, I don't know. And I said, I know. He's been a woman all along. And Russ said, perfect. And so we made him a woman. It's inconsistent with the rest of the movie, but so what?
Well, I guess what you're going for is something sensational and fun, right?
Yeah. We love the movie so much that we hated to end it, and so it ends with a quadruple wedding plus an epilogue. I mean, people are on the edges of their seats for 8 minutes, you know, is the movie over yet? You know, and it keeps going on, and there's another 3 or 4 minutes still to go. It's a strangely structured film.
Speaking with film critic Roger Ebert, were there movies that you started to define yourself by, you know, like... I love this movie, and this movie really says something about who I am.
That happened to me as I was in the last years of high school and the first years of college. There were art theaters in Champaign-Urbana, and also the university had a film society. And I started going to the angry young men films like Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, in which, frankly, you know, as a high school kid in Urbana, I had very little in common with this Borstal boy, played by Tom Courtney. But to me, you know, that movie was my story. It's the Bonnie and Clyde line, you know, where Clyde says, you know what you did? You told my story. I went to see La Dolce Vita by Fellini, and that movie has been a touchstone for me because when I saw it in 1960, there was this 30-year-old journalist in Rome leading this unbelievably glamorous life with all these celebrities and staying up all night and going to orgies and having all of his philosophical friends around him and his wives and his mistresses and miracles and stories to cover. When I saw it again, and I've seen it every 10 years, in 1970 it was somebody about my age, only he was leading a more interesting life than I was, I thought. And when I saw it again in 1980, it was somebody 10 years younger than I was, and he had a lot of problems that I had outgrown. So Marcello, the character in the movie, stays the same, and I can kind of measure, you know, my thoughts about the character as time goes by.
There's so many movies now that are being obviously marketed for the teen audience. Do you feel at a disadvantage when you're reviewing those? Because they're obviously not meant for you, an adult, anyways.
The good movies can be appreciated by anyone, and I gave good reviews to movies like Purple Rain with Prince. When it comes to teenage sex movies, which basically involve teenage boys being rejected by their girlfriends and going to Tijuana where they impress every prostitute in Mexico with what wonderful lovers they are, or movies in which they seduce their French tutor or vice versa, these movies strike me as being very depressing, and I review them from a sociological point of view, with the knowledge that most teenagers are not going to be reading that particular, you know. If you're going to go see My Tutor, you're not going to read my review first. So it's just a sociological phenomenon, a loss of innocence.
Did your parents try to influence your movie-going habits?
I think I had a real good relationship with my parents about the movies. I went to a lot of movies. And then there comes the time in everybody's life when you just go to the movies that you feel like going to. That first time your parents drop you off at the multiplex so you can see Oh, Heavenly Dog starring Benji, and you sneak in to see Saturday Night Fever instead, that's one of the initiation processes into adulthood.
What were the big teen movies when you were 14?
The big teen movies? When I was 14, that would have been in 1956. That would have been pre-Frankie and Annette. You had Elvis Presley. You had Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis. You had, beginning to have in that period, Sandra Dee. You had Doris Day. We can get back to Doris Day if you want to. And you had Pat Boone. But I didn't really go to a lot of teen movies. For some reason, I was more interested in the real stuff. But I feel that one of the people who, if I had to make amends for anyone who I have wronged in my career as a film critic, first on my list would be Doris Day. Because in the 60s, when she was making those movies like Where Were You When the Lights Went Out and movies of that sort, suddenly it was the Woodstock generation. Everybody was a hippie, and Doris Day, with her squeaky, clean, freckled face, was an object of fun and ridicule. You remember those jokes about, I think it was Lenny Bruce who said, I've been in Hollywood so long, I knew Doris Day before she was a virgin. Doris Day, I've been getting into Doris Day a little bit recently. I've listened to a lot of her records. I've looked at some of her old movies. She started at the age of 16 as a big band singer on the road with Les Brown. She has a remarkable group of recorded songs available if you ever want to listen to them over her career. She was in movies like Love Me or Leave Me, movies like Young at Heart with Frank Sinatra, which to this day has some really appealing moments in it. I remember when I was a kid, I loved her in Please Don't Eat the Daisies. I think she was a very, very talented actress and singer who needs to be revived for a new generation and honored for what she did rather than for the being attacked for the fact that she was not Joan Baez in 1968.
Also heard in The Man Who Knew Too Much recently, and was really just startled at how good her performance was. But I won't defend casting her in Love Me or Leave Me, which is the story about Ruth Etting. I thought she was really misplaced.
Well, I mean, if you're going to get technical. But do you have the soundtrack?
No.
Forget about the performance. Just listen to the soundtrack. Forget about Ruth Etting, which is also important, if you're going to get anywhere with Doris Day. And just listen to the record. I have it at home. It's pretty good.
Okay. Now that you're not doing Dogs of the Week regularly on at the movies, do you still make a point of going out to genre films and keeping up with the kung fu movies?
There is no such thing right now as a kung fu movie to keep up with.
Really?
There are still kung fu movies. They play triple features in big cities, but there are no recent kung fu movies that are of particular interest except for an occasional experimental larger budget film by somebody like Chuck Norris. Or Scott Glenn. Scott Glenn was in a picture a year ago where he went to Japan and learned some kung fu. It was a pretty good movie. We felt, in terms of the dogs and stinkers of the week, that we had reached the end of that particular rope. People like you were telling us, why don't you ever pick on good movies for the dog of the week? How come it's always some helpless little kung fu film? That was good advice, and basically what was happening was the end of the show was being wasted on us slapping our hips and chortling over some movie that nobody else would ever see. So our new strategy is, if we have a stinker of the week, it will be a major movie, and we will say, you know, this is such a bad movie, it's a stinker. When we don't have a stinker of the week, we will do a major movie that is that bad. We will do just a regular fourth review. Or we will do something we call an X-ray, which is a little essay on some trend or some star or some development. Didn't you get kind of tired of all those kung fu movies?
Well,
Chicago, they have condemned the theater where we used to see them all.
So that's the real reason, isn't it?
McVickers was, they looked it over and decided it was going to fall down. You knew you were in trouble. Siskel and I, we always taped the show on Thursdays. And so Wednesday night would come around, and we wouldn't have a dog of the week. Now, in the old days, we both had to have a dog of the week. There were two dogs every week. And so we would flip a coin, you know, and go down to the McVickers Theater, which always had three movies for $1.25 or $1.50. You know you are in trouble, as a general rule, when you walk into a movie theater, and most of the customers are sitting on the backs of the chairs with their feet on the seats. And not because they're rude, but because there are other customers down there on the floor that they don't want to get too friendly with.
Right, with more legs than they have.
Yes, with a number of legs divisible by four.
So you have no theater left and no reason left to keep up with those movies.
You're acting as if we have lost track of some valuable genre. I think there are still plenty enough bad movies around for for us without going to see Kung Fu every week.
Do you ever go to pornography movies just to kind of keep up with the conventions of that genre?
And
to see if there's any crossovers?
The last hardcore porno movie that I saw was Debbie Does Dallas. I feel that eroticism depends largely on character and situation, and that the less character you have and the more explicit photography you have, the less erotic it's going to be until finally you're looking at gynecological training films. I feel that recently I've been hearing about some porno actresses. For example, Brian De Palma was telling me about Annette Haven, who he was originally considering as a star of Body Double. Then eventually he didn't cast her. And he was telling me that she considers what she does to be a political statement, and that she has a question and answer session at all of her live performances, and that she's trying to turn people's attitudes around, and she's very serious. There are a couple of others that I've heard about, and I have a feeling that maybe I should go spend a weekend looking at porno and see what's happening. I know the budgets have gotten larger, and some of the actresses and actors are said to be better. But it seems to me that the problem, you have a built-in dramatic problem when the payoff of each scene is something that is not, to me, intrinsically interesting. See, a scene should lead to a dramatic climax instead of to an actual one, in a way. And when you're interested in these characters, suddenly you're looking at all of this plumbing. You know what I mean? It's there's a shock value the first time you go. You think, oh my God, they're really showing that. You know, after the 10th time, you're thinking, oh my God, they're showing that again.
If you're just joining us, my guest is film critic Roger Ebert, who's film critic for the Chicago Sun-Times, film critic for the television movie review program At the Movies, and author of the new book, A Kiss is Still a Kiss, which is a collection of his essays about films.
Essays and also interviews, mostly interviews, in fact.
In the book, you interview a lot of film stars, one of whom you describe as your favorite actor, Robert Mitchum. Mm-hmm. Why is he your favorite?
Not for a logical reason, perhaps. But then again, this is all subjective anyway. Robert Mitchum was the first star that I interviewed was John Wayne, who was in a category all by himself. But John Wayne was more like an icon. Robert Mitchum, who is a little more scandalous, a little more seedy, has been in more film noir type pictures rather than always playing the hero, struck me as being the only living actor I was ever likely to meet who would contain within himself the aura of a legendary person like a Bogart or like a Gable. I mentioned in the book that I was watching him shoot a scene in Los Angeles one day, and I was standing over on the side. He was lighting up a Pall Mall and getting ready to go into the shot. And I thought to myself, remember this moment, because this is the closest that you're ever going to get to having been at Warner Brothers when Bogart was there and when Cagney was still working and people like that. Mitchum has the stuff of legend about him, and that is important to me.
Did that make it harder for you to interview him?
I've never had any trouble interviewing Robert Mitchum. In fact, my favorite piece in the book is the scene where we start out in the McKeesport Holiday Inn, and we're going to drive 15 minutes to a movie location, and 2 hours later we are in Steubenville, Ohio. The key to talking to Robert Mitchum is you must not expect to ask a question and receive an answer. It's stream of consciousness. And the way that I write the pieces about Mitchum whenever I interview him is just simply to try to duplicate for the reader what it was like to be there. I try to pay very close attention to the dialogue, to the nuance, to the timing, to word choices. As Mitchum kind of, who is a very brilliant man with a very good sense of humor, kind of reacts to the comedy that's going on around him. You know, in the conventional print interview, it seems like there's a monologue going on. This guy is, whoever it is just talking to you, and he's telling you everything that you need to know, and it's all very important, and here it all is, and then the piece is over. I feel it's more important to occasionally include everyday speech, small talk, timing, body language, other activities going on in the neighborhood, significance of emotional state, and things like that. And when I have written what I consider to be a good interview, it will read a little bit like a little play with stage directions and dialogue and parts where nothing important is being said, but maybe some character is being revealed.
You've interviewed a lot of stars in the years that you've been writing about movies. Do they ever make ridiculous demands of you about what they will or won't do, what they won't talk about? And if that happens, how do you handle it?
In general, no, they don't. In the book, there's an interview with Jerry Lewis at the Cannes Film Festival. He got out a tape recorder. He tape recorded it, apparently out of paranoia. What I am astounded by is the number of occasions where totally unexpected and startling things happen that the star does nothing at all to conceal. Another interview in this book is with Tony Curtis, also at the Cannes Film Festival. I went to interview him, and during the course of the interview, he looked out the window of his hotel room, saw a woman on the sidewalk that he found attractive, and started screaming at her to come up to his room. He was shouting his name and his room number in full view and hearing of about 500 people on the terrace of the Carlton Hotel. He was really out of control that day. And when I left, I had a very strange encounter to record. Movie stars have been interviewed so often that sometimes you find some very revealing things happening because the interviewer is almost not visible to them.
Well, what do you mean?
That there's always been an interviewer there. I mean, Robert Mitchum has been a movie actor for 40 years. If I'm sitting in the backseat of his car, is he going to be thinking, oh, my God, the press is here? No, the press has always been there. You know, 20 years ago it was Rex Reed. 40 years ago it was Luella Parsons. You know, the in a way, the press has always been in Robert Mitchum's backseat. And so if you can adopt the fly-on-the-wall approach of just kind of quietly sitting there and observing everything that's going on, you are going to see somebody who is not especially monitoring his behavior.
When you go out to Los Angeles to interview a star, do you feel uncomfortable there?
I did. I used to have the received opinion about Los Angeles, you know, suburbs in search of another suburb. It's kind of a hedonistic city. It's industry-oriented, at least in the areas in which I move. I think it helps me as a movie critic and as an interviewer to live in Chicago, where there is no movie industry at all, and where the same kinds of values are not as important. When I go to Los Angeles, I think I see things sometimes because I'm an outsider. The interview with Michael Caine in the book involves a lot of the tribal behavior at lunch at Ma Maison, a popular restaurant. If I were eating at Ma Maison every day of the week, it would become invisible to me. And so it's important in covering the movie business, I think, to see it freshly, which you can do if you have just come in from 3 months in Chicago. It helps you wonderfully to clear the mind.
Roger Ebert, film critic for the Chicago Sun-Times, co-host of the TV program At the Movies, and author of the book A Kiss is Still a Kiss.